I next met with faculty member Dr. Bradley Monk, and to begin, he picked up on a topic discussed by Dr. Letterman, the current management of recurrent ovarian cancer.
So, as you know, the most common relapsed ovarian cancer patient is a patient that's called platinum-sensitive relapse. That's what happens generally. And in my mind, bevacizumab is a second-line drug. It's approved in basically every second-line scenario, platinum-resistant, platinum-sensitive, with five chemotherapy backbones. And probably every patient needs bevacizumab in that setting, or maybe even frontline, but needs bevacizumab. So I prefer to cross through that window in that platinum-sensitive relapse patient. Now, the complicated factor is that in platinum-sensitive relapse, based on OCEANS and 213, that includes a maintenance phase. And I wouldn't personally ever abandon bevacizumab maintenance in favor of PARP maintenance, even in a BRCA germline mutated patient. So I look at PARP as a third-line drug and Bev as a second-line drug, and I think it's just that simple.
Obviously, in order to, I guess, to come to that conclusion, you feel like the therapeutic benefit of maintenance Bev or Bev plus maintenance is greater than with PARP inhibitors. But I mean, in the niraparib trial, the hazard rate was 0.27 for the BRCA germline or whatever, you know, it was under 3 for the BRCA germline, which you said you still wouldn't use. And isn't that a higher hazard rate than what you see by adding Bev?
I do not look at it that way at all. See, you're comparing one treatment versus the other. I am looking about the sequencing of events or the agents. I'm looking about which agent to use first. That patient that you just described, that germline BRCA patient, she's going to get both drugs. It's only a matter of when. And so that's the role of molecular testing, right? So molecular testing can either be germline, somatic, and somatic can either be BRCA or HRD. And it's the molecular signature that allows me to sequence the agents. And that's the most important point that we can make. They're going to get both drugs. It's not one or, it's one and it's only a matter of when. And when is informed by the molecular signature.
Well, how does the molecular signature change what you do?
Well, if she is HRD negative, I may delay PARP for subsequent lines of therapy. So I may use PARP fourth or fifth line, okay? At the same time, if she is BRCA positive, I would use PARP third line. And what happens is that people get mired into these indications. The indications for olaparib, rucaparib, and niraparib are all different. But let's face it, the indications are so broad that now with niraparib's approval, most patients are going to be able to get PARP in some scenario. So it's only a matter of sequencing.
Just to clarify, though, again, you know, we, of course, are always in the habit of asking investigators what they do. A lot of times we do them by surveys. It's just that this has only been, like, whatever, a couple weeks now. You're one of the first people I've even talked to.
Since March 27th, yep, niraparib.
But in any event, I'm really trying to speculate, and I'd like you to speculate. What do you think we're going to find when we go out and ask 20 ovarian cancer investigators what they're doing? Do you think they're going to do what you just said, or do you think they're going to bring PARP in and drop the Bev and, let's say, platinum sensitive?
It's a great question. And, you know, it's challenging to predict what people are going to do, but I suspect that many people are not going to agree with me. I think that we're riding a wave of enthusiasm. You just said that in the NOVA trial in the BRCA mutated group, the hazard ratio is 0.27. The medians go from 5.5 to 21 months. They're so excited about that.
And incidentally, that was the, I can't remember which one was 0.27, which one was 0.3, but it was almost the identical hazard rate with Solo 2 with olaparib in BRCA germline.
That's right. Solo 2 is 0.3. But we have to be more controlled, take the emotion out of it. Let's face it, GOG-213 has a 5-month improvement survival advantage. It's the only one.
You're talking about with Bev?
Yeah, with Bev. So if you want to be data-driven.
5 months.
Yeah, 5 months of overall survival.
And what's the hazard rate?
The hazard ratio is not great. I don't have it in my mind. It's like 8.4 or something. But still, the microenvironment has changed because these are highly sensitive patients. They get lots of subsequent therapy, but they live longer. These patients need Bev. And remember, this is the key point also, is that if you delay the use of bevacizumab to the end, the risk of GI perforation is higher. The risk of GI perforation doesn't even appear in the label for platinum-sensitive relapsed ovarian cancer with bevacizumab because the risk is trivial, if not non-existent. So use Bev early. It's extremely well tolerated. It's better tolerated than PARP, hands down for sure. And use it, get through it. And that doesn't mean that it's better than PARP. It just means it needs to be used. And then we'll use PARP next. It's that simple. But don't do one versus the other, because these patients are going to get 5, 6, 7 lines of therapy and live for years.
So you're thinking more long-term chronic maintenance kind of strategy.
Listen, ovarian cancer is managed. It's not cured. And I'm trying to manage it. If you look at this as really treatment, where it's one and done, it's not the way it works. I'm looking at the trajectory and the long-term outcome.
What about platinum-resistant disease? And people who haven't had Bev. Bev first, right?
Yeah, it's a no-brainer, right? So the activity of PARP inhibitors is informed by three things. Molecular signature, number of lines of therapy, and platinum sensitivity. So you just said, oh, how about platinum resistance? So that right there, that's one of those three things. You tick that box. PARP is going to work poorly for that. And Bev works very well. It, you know, more than doubles the hazard ratio. It improves symptoms. It's the only patient-reported outcome result that is favorable. So Bev is an ideal drug. And again, for that second-line patient. So if you get a platinum-resistant relapse second line, use Bev. If you get a platinum-sensitive relapse, use Bev. And then ultimately, PARPs are for subsequent lines of therapy, whether it be third, fourth, fifth, or beyond.
What do you think about the possible strategy of using chemotherapy and adding just Bev in during the chemo, and then for maintenance using a PARP inhibitor?
I don't like it. I think that you want to get all of the benefit out of Bev you can. And remember, the response rate in GOG-213 is almost 80%. So these patients are responding, they're developing cumulative chemotherapy-related toxicities. It's an ideal scenario to transition now into the maintenance phase of bevacizumab, which is very well tolerated. And so let's put some numbers on it. So let's say you have a BRCA-mutated patient. She's going to get frontline surgery and treatment, and she's going to recur at about 2 years, okay? So then she's going to get chemotherapy and Bev maintenance, and she's going to go another year and a half. So you got 6 months of frontline, 2 months of chemotherapy, and then another year and a half. So you're already at 4 years, and you've only had 2 lines of therapy. Then you're going to give her platinum again, and she's going to get to 4.5 years. And then she's going to get PARP, and then she's going to be to 6 years, and she's only had 4 lines of therapy. So that's a typical scenario. 4 lines of therapy, 6 years, she has little or no cumulative toxicity, and by then we'll have immunotherapy approved. And then she'll get that, and then this patient's going to live 10 years unless you over-treat her, okay? The chemotherapy is every bit maybe more toxic than the cancer. The second thing is, if you look at the niraparib label carefully, this distinction between maintenance and treatment is very complicated. So niraparib is approved as maintenance, and olaparib and rucaparib are as treatment. You know, what does that really mean? And in the niraparib label, it says that you have to start it within 8 weeks of platinum. It actually says that. So it says niraparib should be started within 8 weeks of the last dose of platinum. And so how serious are we about that statement? Because it's not in the indication. It's under the usage component of the package insert, product information. So our payer's going to say, oh, we're sorry. You know, that's 57 days. You know, you missed it by 1 day.
Do you think people really do that?
I don't know. It's brand new.
Hmm.
But this distinction between maintenance and treatment is something that we need to have more discussion about.
I agree. And actually, I was mentioning at the meeting the concept of, you know, people don't really call tamoxifen maintenance. Although, you know, it is given for a long period of time, but it's viewed more as a monotherapy. But I guess Jonathan brought up this concept of, you know, trying to long-term maintain the state induced by chemotherapy. And that makes sense to me also.
That's right. That's a great analogy. But think about that. In the niraparib label, it now has 8 weeks. So is that now the threshold? 57 versus 56 days?
Where are we today in terms of germline and somatic testing, particularly as it relates to treatment of ovarian cancer?
I think we all understand that every epithelial ovarian cancer patient should have germline BRCA testing based on ASCO, NCCN, and SGO guidelines. But I think that we need to really begin to talk about panel testing, not just germline BRCA, but other germline mutations. And people say, well, what do you do, Brad, if you find them? Well, as you know, there are now three NCCN guidelines for other BRCA-like germline mutations, BRIP1, RAD51C, and RAD51D. And then certainly there's the Lynch syndrome genes too, which there are NCCN guidelines of what to do when mutations are found.
Is that enough to use a PARP inhibitor, for example? Do you approach them from the point of view of PARP inhibitors? I mean, not talking about genetic counseling, but just the use of PARP inhibitors. Do you treat them like BRCA germline?
So, right, there are two reasons. One is for the kindred. The second is for predictive biomarkers, and the answer is yes. BRIP1, RAD51C, and RAD51D, yes. So teach that. Help the world begin to expand their practice in germline testing using a panel in all ovarian cancer patients.
Okay, so how about if I say, given the fact that you have niraparib available, even if you don't need any testing for, and you still see benefit, how about if I say, putting aside the sort of genetic counseling issues, which may or may not be important, from a therapeutic point of view, how about if I say from a practical point of view, in terms of therapy, you don't really need BRCA testing?
Well, you do, right? Because we're coming full circle here. Testing for HRD and testing for germline BRCA helps inform the sequence of the medications.
So it's in terms of potential benefit then, not whether...
Yes.
So you still think it's important in terms of a predictor of benefit. Yeah, that makes sense.
Because you counsel your patient. And you've practiced oncology, and everyone listening does, and then you do too. So the patient wants to know what's the chance it's going to work.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's a good point.
And you can't say, oh, I don't know. I didn't look at the genetics of your tumor. That's not a good answer. The answer is I looked at the genetics of your tumor, and based on the genetics, the number of lines of therapy, and the platinum sensitivity, the response rate is about this, and it's rather precise.
All right, well, I have another devil's advocate question for you. How about, again, thinking from primarily a therapeutic point of view, how about if I say maybe the first thing that should be done, and I think this was actually presented by somebody at the SGO meeting because somebody told me about it. How about if we say what you really ought to do is some kind of NGS testing on the tumor, and then if they've got BRCA or something else, if you want, you can go back and figure out whether it's germline, but at least you'll get all somatic. And, you know, from sort of a clinical flow point of view, it makes sense to look at the tumor first.
Yeah, I love that idea. And that makes sense, except we have some of these other germline mutations. So that's fine. But remember, it's not just about BRCA, it's about BRIP1, RAD51C, RAD51D, Lynch, and so on. So if we have the bioinformatics to do that, I think that's fine. Because all, you know, germline mutations, they're present in the tumor.
Right.
And if you use the tumor as a triage, it's fine.
I want to kind of turn to the one that you were more involved with, which dealt with a bunch of issues. And we began talking about ovarian cancer, but we were actually talking about, you know, sort of non-PARP issues. And you began the meeting by talking about reviewing some of the data related to treatment of advanced ovarian cancer. Particularly, you went through some of the stuff you were referring to earlier related to bevacizumab. Could you just go back and talk a little bit about some of the key data sets that came out in the last few years related to bevacizumab, and sort of, you know, you were talking about it before, the way that has led you to integrate the drug into your own practice.
Right. So ovarian cancer is probably the most active drug for bevacizumab. The editorial by Stan Kay in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, when we presented our single agent phase 2 data, Bob Berger, the editorial was called Bevacizumab, Its Finest Hour. So bevacizumab is generally not considered to be active as a single agent in the other tumors that it's labeled in, such as colorectal cancer and lung, but it is active as a single agent. And so it kind of speaks to the biology that ovarian cancer is very angiogenesis driven, and really ascites is angiogenesis out of control. So around the world, it's labeled as a frontline drug. It's not labeled as a frontline drug, again, with chemotherapy and maintenance in the United States. But in the United States, it's labeled as mostly a second-line drug in platinum-resistant recurrent ovarian cancer with three chemotherapy options, topotecan, paclitaxel, and pegylated liposomal doxorubicin. And it's labeled with two other chemotherapy options in platinum-sensitive relapse, carboplatin paclitaxel and carboplatin gemcitabine. And in the sensitive setting, because the response rates are almost as high as frontline, there's a maintenance component as well. So five chemotherapy options, it's a second line drug. And although the frontline indication is not here, some people still use it, but rarely.
What about you? I hear people talking about the high-risk situation.
In patients frontline that have large volumes of residual disease or stage 4, both the two pivotal trials, GOG-218 and ICON-7, there was an 8-month survival advantage. It wasn't the primary endpoint, but it's provocative. And I love that idea, quite frankly. But I have trouble getting it reimbursed because it's off-label.
And, you know, globally, do you sort of view it as, you know, risk reduction thing in general, that whatever stage you're going to use it, there's going to be some added benefit, and, you know, we just don't have the research to prove it up front?
Well, I think there's no question that there is added benefit. The question is the financial toxicity. So the way drugs are reimbursed in this country is obviously different than other countries. But in let's say, France and Germany, two highly developed countries, Bev is almost always used frontline, based on their reimbursement structure, but that's not the way it is here. So it's definitely rational. There is a benefit, and the benefit's probably exaggerated based on the bulk of the disease.
So there are two other things that we chatted about that I want to just sort of get back into. One is neoadjuvant therapy. The other is IP intraperitoneal therapy. Seems like these are issues that have been out there for a long time. Where are we today with them?
So neoadjuvant chemotherapy is a strategy to begin primary advanced ovarian cancer treatment with chemotherapy rather than surgery when the surgery would not result in a complete resection or R0. And that's common. Frequently, you can figure that out on a CAT scan. If you want to do a laparoscopy to assess the extent of disease, fine. But about half of patients with advanced, newly diagnosed ovarian cancer begin with chemotherapy and have the surgery between the third and the fourth cycle. So it's common. Intraperitoneal chemotherapy, I think, is dead for now. There are a small group of people that think that the old data still is relevant. The old data is very provocative, but the new data that has a better control arm invalidates the earlier data because the earlier data didn't have the right control arm. But when the right control arm is used, which is dose-dense weekly paclitaxel, and every 3-week carboplatin, there is no benefit to intraperitoneal chemotherapy. So if people use intraperitoneal chemotherapy today, and it's only a small subset, they latch on to the old data and don't really, in my humble opinion, don't really understand that the control arm in those prior studies was wrong.
Getting back to neoadjuvant therapy, what regimen do you typically utilize? And then in the patients who then do go to surgery, how do you approach post-op treatment?
Right. So there are three options for that chemotherapy neoadjuvant patient. Many people continue to use every 3-week carboplatin and paclitaxel, an AUC of 5 or 6, paclitaxel 175 milligrams per square meter over 3 hours. That's still common. I think, though, the more common regimen is to take the paclitaxel and divide it into a weekly 80 milligrams per square meter. 80 times 3 is 240. That's more than the 175, so it's dose dense. So the most common is every 3-week carboplatin and dose dense paclitaxel. It would be acceptable to use bevacizumab as well with the every 3-week regimen. Some people do that, but if you do that, you shouldn't give it the cycle before surgery and the cycle after. So the most current regimen is dose dense weekly. The second would be every 3-week. There are some people that would add bevacizumab. You talked about the high volume disease where this is a potential benefit. But again, don't give it right before and right after the surgery.
Another issue that we talked about at the meeting that really has been fascinating to me over the years, and sort of sticking with the topic of ovarian cancer, is a new agent that's not approved right now. But from, you know, what I keep seeing, and Dr. Beer again presented information on this, this is the antibody drug conjugate mirvetuximab. Can you talk a little bit about what your understanding about this agent is, how it works, what the efficacy tolerability is? I don't know if you maybe had patients on it.
Yeah, it's a very exciting agent. It's a, as you said, it's an antibody drug conjugate to the folate receptor. The folate receptor is overexpressed on ovarian cancer cells, for the most part not present on normal cells, and the same company that made TDM1 has now made a sort of similar antibody drug conjugate to this folate receptor. It's active particularly in second and third line. We have open at our site, and it's really around the world, a randomized, you know, phase three trial of adding, doing it versus physician's choice chemotherapy. I'm excited about it. There was some initial concerns about eye toxicity, but with some steroid drops and some tweaking of the doses, that really is not a problem to any degree. So I think this is one of the most exciting agents in development right now.
Sorry, did you say you've had patients on it?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Have you had any patients that had responses that you thought were clinically meaningful?
It's too early to tell. I haven't had one yet. It's too early. We're just getting started.
And the ophthalmologic issue, what's your view on that? It's what, like a keratitis or what is?
Yeah, it's a class effect. And with steroid drops, really doesn't seem to be a problem. It's scary because our vision is so important, but it's mild. And I always emphasize that it's completely reversible.
Any thoughts about whether you think this is going to come into practice? I mean, based on what you've read and seen, is it something you would like to use or do we need more data?
Yeah, so I always say this. I say we're at dusk in the angiogenesis world. It's the middle of the day for PARPs. It's the morning of immunotherapy, and antibody drug conjugates are tomorrow.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, you know, T-DM1 that you were talking about in breast cancer, brentuximab vedotin in lymphomas, particularly Hodgkin lymphoma, they are happening now. They're benefiting patients. But I guess when I first heard about these things, I thought there were going to be a lot more.
Yeah, so in ovarian cancer I'm talking about. So,
oh, yeah, sure, absolutely.
So, yeah, just in ovarian cancer. We're coming to the end of angiogenesis. We're in PARP now, but immunotherapy is coming. We just don't have a lot of data on antibody-drug conjugates. There's another one made by Bayer against mesothelin. So there are some rational tumor antigens, and we'll get there. Like you said, the paradigm is here. The technology is developed. I just think that we need the data to mature.
Let's move on now and just talk a little bit about endometrial cancer beyond what we were talking about with checkpoint inhibitors, as well as cervical cancer. And Angela Secord covered that in the meeting. And one of the issues that she talked about in both of these tumors was what you were talking about before, bevacizumab. So there are data out there in endometrial cancer. She went through them. And of course, it's approved in cervical cancer. Can you talk today about your view of how, if at all, you see bevacizumab being integrated into the management of these two cancers?
Yeah, thank you for that. Let's start with endometrial cancer. So yesterday, I saw two patients with second-line recurrent endometrial cancer. We understand that the front line is, you know, carboplatin paclitaxel. And one patient was a patient that I admitted for my partner who was on single-agent doxorubicin. She had a malignant bowel obstruction, and I'm going to go around after this and send her to hospice. The other patient was a patient that was on pegylated liposomal doxorubicin and bevacizumab and had stable disease. I get it, it's one patient versus one patient, but that was my experience yesterday, that in the patient that with bevacizumab we were able to maintain tumor control, and with doxorubicin as a single agent or even single agent PLD, not very active. So I'm a fan of it. There's a reimbursement issue, and we were able to get it paid for in the patient that I saw in the clinic that has stable disease after six cycles, and she has a good quality of life.
In your mind, what are the global clinical numbers if one of your fellows comes up and says, in terms of what you see bevacizumab adding to chemotherapy in endometrial cancer, kind of globally, how do you see it affecting, let's say, PFS and overall survival?
Yeah, so I don't have any survival data. You know, the PFS is probably not quite as good as ovarian, which is, you know, 3 to 4 months. It's probably only a 3-month benefit. Yeah. But there are extreme responders to bevacizumab. And you already said it, we need a biomarker. And, you know, we've all seen these extreme responders. And the patient that I told you about is an extreme responder. So you can't just look at the median. And you said this with the immunotherapy, it's really about the tail. There will be some extreme responders in endometrial cancer where bevacizumab is a game changer.
So when you say extreme responders, are you kind of referring more to the chemo plus Bev with Bev maintenance kind of platform or a single agent platform?
No, a combination. Yeah.
Aren't there people also who benefit from Bev monotherapy, like you hear about people with ascites, et cetera?
Yes, mostly ovarian cancer, but yes.
Right. Yeah, and that's what I was talking about there in terms of extreme. So you think they're extreme responders, though, in endometrial?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow, that's interesting. How about cervical cancer? Of course, we've had the approval of Bev now for a little bit. How's it actually playing out in your practice?
We did a randomized phase 3 trial in the gynecologic oncology group. There's a 4-month improvement in overall survival when bevacizumab is added to chemotherapy, again, commonly platinum taxane-based chemotherapy. I think it's the global standard. When we survey our colleagues around the world, you know, newly diagnosed advanced disease or recurrent disease, they get, you know, chemotherapy. Bev, we had a new chemotherapy start yesterday. I was in the clinic again. An unfortunate woman who we thought was cured had chemotherapy and radiation for a stage 2B cancer. She had about a 70 to 80% cure rate. And she had a 3-month PET scan, and she has, you know, widely metastatic disease. So we're going to give her chemotherapy and Bev, and we'll see what happens.
Any observations or thoughts in terms of complications specifically in cervical cancer for people receiving Bev, particularly local pelvic complications, fistulae, et cetera, in relation to radiation therapy?
So there is a very small, what we call GI perforation rate in ovarian, but what happens in cervical is a vaginal fistula rate. It's not the same thing. When you get a GI perforation ovarian cancer, you get a blown out appendix, a ruptured diverticular abscess, a duodenal ulcer that ruptures. But a fistula between the rectum and the vagina can happen almost at 9% of cervical cancer patients. So the GI perforation in ovarian is frequently lethal. It's a terrible thing in cervical cancer, but it's not lethal. But it's much more common in cervical cancer, these vaginal fistulas. And it needs to be carefully considered as a risk and weighed against the 4-month improvement in overall survival. And I think you just mentioned that those patients that do get fistulas in cervical cancer, all of them, to our knowledge, have had prior pelvic radiation. But again, the risk is still relatively, I guess, low, 9%.
Anything else going on in either endometrial or cervical cancer in terms of new agents, new strategies that you want to comment on?
So there's a lot of interest in this listeria-based immunotherapy. We can use this bacterium as a vector to carry HPV antigens. There's a late-breaking abstract presented at the SGO showing that phase 2, that this agent's probably active. And so there's a randomized phase 3 trial called Aim to Serve, where this agent is used as maintenance after frontline chemotherapy and radiation in very high-risk patients. And we're excited about that. That's a global trial. And in fact, that's the only phase 3 trial right now of immunotherapy in cervical cancer.
So, you know, I always kind of joke at meetings that I never understand, you know, pathways and biology. And actually, I was thinking that it kind of reminds me of when I do math with my 11-year-old son. You know, he gives me this sort of blank look, you know. So why don't you take a shot at explaining how the Listeria thing actually works?
So Listeria is a gram-positive bacterium. It's scalable, and it elicits a very, very robust immune response. And so you can develop plasmids and attenuate the bacteria. And this attenuated Listeria bacteria, which is loaded with HPV antigens, can be infused intravenously. Now, you might imagine infusing bacteria intravenously might cause some chills and some hypotension. So, you know, we give them some fluids and some Tylenol and monitor them carefully. And then 72 hours, even though it's attenuated, it's really not a pathogen now, we chase them with some antibiotics just in case. And we've seen some changes in the tumor immune microenvironment as kind of a window of opportunity study. We've seen a complete response in 2 patients in the phase 2 experience. So we're trying to do a phase 3 trial now in maintenance after completing chemotherapy and radiation called Aim to Serve.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special highlights program of a satellite CME symposium on the management of ovarian cancer.